Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contains information from the following sources. Baseball's New Frontier, A History of Expansion, 1961 to 1998, by Fran Zimaniec. Tales from the Philadelphia Phillies Dugout, by Rich Westcott. The Integration of Baseball in Philadelphia, by Christopher Threston. The May 18th and September 11th, 1963 editions of the Philadelphia Inquirer. The April 8th and April 26th, 1963 editions of Sports Illustrated. And 162-0, Imagine a Phillies Perfect Season, by Paul Kurtz. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a whole new year of Dirty Innings.
Wow. 2055.
Welcome, friends. I am Phillies writer for SB Nation's Phillies site, The Good Fight, Justin Clue. And with me, clearing his throat on mic, never remembering where that cough button is contributor to Baseball Prospectus and all-around Twitter badass, Dr. Trevor Strunk. Hello, Dr. Trev.
Hello, Dr. Clue. Do you have a cough button on your mic?
My cough button is me getting up from the microphone. Well, it's asking you a question that I know you will give a long-winded, gas-bagged response to, and then getting up from my chair, sprinting into the next room to cough, and then returning. That's my cough button.
There was one time, I don't think it was on a podcast with you, but it might have been, because it might have been like early on when you were setting things up, which is not gas-baggy, of course, but just like important to set things up, where a cat was yelling, and I needed to let it out, so I just took off my headphones, and I was like, well, I'm pretty sure Justin will talk for 45 seconds here. So I definitely can get the cat out of the room and he'll never be the wiser. When I sat down, you were like, and that's the story of the game. So Trevor, have you ever, and you set up a really nice question for me. And I was like, yeah, Justin, really interesting talk.
Slapping your headphones back on, kicking a cat with one hand, rocking a baby with your one arm. Yeah, we're multitaskers here on the Dirty Inning, but mostly we're here just together to host this show on which we discuss the most laughable, forgotten, or useless innings in the history of the Philadelphia Phillies. And folks, we got a real doozy of an inning for you this time, and we're really flipping the script on you a little bit in the new year. We're going to explore some new areas that this podcast has never traveled to before. But Trev, before we do that, I do want to take a quick second to, as we prepare ourselves for another slog around the sun, I think we should take a second and address another, any new listeners we may have accrued over the course of the last few weeks. As anyone who listens to any of the Good Fight's quality Phillies podcasts will tell you,
oh, they're all really good.
And as I informed Trev via text message comprised solely of exclamation points and the number ones, the Dirty Inning was named by the Philly Voice as one of the best Philly podcasts of 2018. And that's always been a personal goal of mine, frankly, not to win that, have that specific recognition.
I think that may be the first year they've done this.
I agree. But what I mean is I it's been a personal goal of mine, and part of what's made this podcast so much fun is to not make it just about the Phillies, a franchise that has mostly sucked, but about the chaotic, irregular pulse of the city of Philadelphia in general.
Yeah, I agree. No, I was going to say my favorite line from Stephen Silver. It's really the author Stephen Silver is a nice guy. I know him, and he was saying, which was really nice. He's never said this to me before. I didn't know he was a listener, but he said it reminded him of the good old days of Twitter, like the days of Phillies Twitter when it was like 2010 to, I don't know, 14 or so, when everyone just stopped caring. Which was nice, because that really was a fun time and people really were like super creative and really fun. And it was nice to know that people think that we do that.
They called us social media veterans in the article, and I think nothing solidifies that as much as referring to the good old days of Twitter, which are now that many years in the past.
In a nice article about us than to call us social media veterans.
Well, in any case, I just wanted to first thank the people who have listened to this podcast thus far and welcome any new listeners and point out that this is a podcast not just for the people who love how much baseball sucks, but who can look back on the decades of clownish mishaps of a single franchise and laugh until there's blood at the back of their throats. But it's also for anyone who likes a good story, because I feel like we tell a good story. Sometimes we tell a good story. Other times we tell just rambling stories with no point. But some weeks we actually manage to tell an impactful, effective story that branches out from the sport of baseball. So yeah. I would invite anyone who does enjoy those things to check in with us as we publish these episodes biweekly. Because
for the old episodes too, they're good.
Yeah, and they're only going to get better. So, yeah,
we figured out how to record tonight. So, you know, it's only onward and upward from here.
We're taking a truly intimidating series of technological leaps and bounds here in the new year, frankly. So, folks, if you could see us recording, you would know that what I'm saying is true. We are living here in the future on the Dirty Inning, a podcast in which we explore the past.
And I was really excited when you told me what this inning was today, Justin. I was itching. We've been doing, and I've loved these episodes. I don't mean any ill will against them. I think they've been really interesting and really good changes of pace. But I miss going back in time for these. Like, I miss going into like talking about people I've never heard of and will never hear of again. I smiled when someone said that Omar Vizquel would be elected into the Hall of Fame through the collusion of the writers. It made me happy because collusion is now a good thing to me.
Yes.
I we've been doing current things like Andrew McCutchen's best game against the Phillies or Gene Segura's best game against the Phillies. Like, that's okay. But I'm really pleased that we're going a little further back for this one.
This podcast is always at its best when it is at its least relevant to current events. I would agree. Yes.
All the besuited listeners of the past will tell you as much.
Well, it's going to be a big year for the Dirty Inning, I can promise you that. But speaking of big years, Trev, 1963 was a pretty big year. Now I don't have to put in the musical interlude I was going to include. 1963, pretty big for all of humanity, from nationally because of Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail and I Have a Dream speech, to internationally with the tragedy of the Kennedy assassination, to pop culturally with the first James Bond movie being released and Beatlemania reaching the shores of the United States near the end of the year, to sports with the Pro Football Hall of Fame opening in Canton, and the first NHL entry draft is held in Canada, I believe in Montreal, but hockey-minded listeners can feel free to correct that.
Please, we don't know anything about it.
It was also, Trevor, a pretty terrific year for revenge.
And we're not talking about the terrible things that we did in the Vietnam War, which was beginning.
That's correct. We are not. Trevor, do you have any revenge plots you're looking to execute within the new year?
Revenge plots. Oh, that's a really good question. There's this guy, let's call him JS, who I got a real bone to pick with. He's a prominent Phillies guy. It's not Jim Salisbury, that lovable scamp. It's another JS. So I just like to see him take it down a peg. And I think you've worked with him before. I'm looking to see this guy just get taken down a few pegs and really put in his place. But, I shouldn't go any further.
I'd hate to be that guy. Wow. Yeah, well, it sounds like there's a real growl in the back of your voice when you say his name. Like a real disgust, a really guttural sense of dread kind of like swept over me while you were talking about him.
His family friendly chippered voiced brand of baseball is not only enjoyable but rage inducing.
As who listeners race to figure out who exactly you could be talking about, I can only reiterate the truth that revenge was on everyone's mind in 1963.
Justin, do you have any revenge? Are you gonna commit it?
No, I had a pretty reasonable 2018, so I don't
you
think
had a
I
lot of revenge in 2018. You got it all out
I got it all out of my system. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good.
It's moving like into the new shopping. Year. I did that early.
Yeah, my enemies were very well taken care of. Don't you worry about that, Trev. Don't forget to start your car tomorrow morning.
Just like that. Oh, yeah, okay. Thanks, man. I always forget to start my car. Just sitting in there.
Yeah, it's a perfectly normal, reasonable reminder to give another adult to do something that you were going to do anyway. Nothing suspicious about that. Well, in September of 1963, John F. Kennedy looked at the moon and swore he would send men to walk on its face. And around the time of the inning we will discuss today, America was bopping out a song about a woman threatening her harasser with her violent, unstable boyfriend.
Oh, yeah, that is what that song's about, isn't it?
Yeah, I for some reason thought it was about a guy who died in a motorcycle accident and came back to life.
That's the movie My Boyfriend's Back. It's a horror comedy.
Yeah, I had no idea. I really blurred those two things.
Well, I mean, together. They're called the exact same thing and they're based off the idea. So it's okay. I understand why.
I can't imagine they don't use the song in the movie.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're not going to call your movie My Boyfriend's Back and not get the rights for My Boyfriend's Back. I mean, you may as well call it like Motorcycle Boyfriend at that point, or like Help My Boyfriend's a Zombie.
You know, I can't stress how much I want you to start your car in the morning. I really, I really, really can't wait.
Thanks, man. Yeah. This is really helpful. My kids are going to be like, Dad, the car is starting so much faster now.
And on the 10th of September, 1963, in a game against the Houston Colt 45s, the Phillies were about to get a bit of revenge of their own.
Yes.
That's right, folks. Today we will be talking about a game in which the Phillies do not falter, stumble, or faceplant out the gate. This is a Phillies team that wins the baseball game that we will discuss, and they win it quite handedly, as we will discuss. It is a dirty inning, just going the other way.
Way to start the year.
Yeah, we thought we'd change things up for you and see what it's like to feel good about, you know, life at the end of an episode of the Dirty Inning. So we appreciate your patience as we take the formula of the Dirty Inning that has been so successful and just ruin it, just tear it in half right in front of you and throw it just straight into the wet, wet garbage.
Listen to this one after Macharper doesn't sign with us.
Yeah. Yeah. This will cure all your post Macharper ills. I promise.
Oh, I felt so bad until I remembered that one good game they had in 1963.
And then it's the clouds lifted and the future just seemed a lot brighter because the 1963 Phillies won a game and finished in fourth place. It was just made me a lot happier of a person. Well, the 1963 Phillies and Colt 45s were previewed in Sports Illustrated right next to each other. The Phillies had been pretty much the worst for most of the previous season, but had caught fire near the end, smoking the National League with a 30-14 record to close out the year.
Nice.
For one thing, many of the players suddenly had good years, Sports Illustrated wrote, a miracle not likely to repeat itself. So folks were riding pretty high on this squad. just
brutal.
I mean, you've seen a Sports Illustrated baseball preview issue before in your life, I say.
Yeah, no, they're fairly common. Yeah.
And I mean, this isn't going to surprise anybody, but just like aesthetically looking at this issue was there are no images on either of these pages. They are formatted and laid out exactly the same way. With like a little rectangle on the top that says the team name and the headline describing them. Then
it's like a baseball perspective.
Yeah, like two very dense, very small typeface written paragraphs. And then like another gray rectangle that breaks down their hitting, fielding, and pitching. And that's it. Each team got
one. We need more space to talk about UCLA basketball.
Back then, it's Sports Illustrated. They were probably, you know, in 1963. They're talking about the Hall of Fame opening in Canton for the NFL. They were talking about the NHL entry draft. You know, they had to save some space. They couldn't just.
Yeah, they had plenty of stuff to talk about. They didn't have to talk about the Phillies for 70 pages or something. Not like today.
That you'll be absolutely floored to learn that 2 weeks later, Sports Illustrated covered the Phillies in a feature story. But we'll get to that in a second.
What about?
We'll get to that in 1 second. The general take on the Phillies in 63 was that they had let the farm system dry up after 1950. And as time went on, and the Whiz Kids became the Was Kids, as Sports Illustrated wrote.
Wait, didn't they become the Whiz Kids?
They didn't become the Whiz Kids. This is the Whiz Kid, the literal Whiz Kids becoming the Was Kids. The Whiz Kids were just a bunch of old men in 83 when Pete Rose was just like fat and out of shape and terrible.
Sorry. Yeah, I thought that was a name that we gave to the Whiz Kids after they got
old. I don't think a lot of them got old that old in Philadelphia, to be honest.
Just all died.
They ran out on the field one day and that was it. That's all she wrote.
Fortunately, we're tragically firebombed.
I'm about to tell you, that might not be too far from the truth.
Oh, no.
But they had, real quick, close the loop on that. They had no reserves. Just whatever talent they could get from Phillies general manager John Quinn's trades. Their farm system just wasn't producing a whole lot of talent.
Legendary general manager.
And only now, in 1963, were they starting to see signs of life. But they would need more than a couple of beating hearts to rise to the top. And that's pretty much what Sports Illustrated was saying in this issue. The Colt 45s were, they were a new team. They weren't in good shape at all.
Did they have Joe Morgan yet?
I believe they did. Mm-hmm. He actually had a walk-off.
Did that guy ever do anything?
He had a walk-off win against the Phillies. Something else we're going to get to in a minute. So it was Sports Illustrated writes a feature story on the Phillies 2 weeks later using the angle that, and stop me if you've heard this one, the people of Philadelphia love losers. And now that the team was developing, fans just didn't know how to react, Trev. It's just like, what is going on around here? So to read directly.
I love this. I love that this narrative can live with the other narrative that like Philadelphia hates losers and every Philadelphia team can never get a big star because the stars know they won't be treated well. But also they love losers and can only root for losers.
Again, yeah, that's what I kind of had to like grapple with that for a second reading this story because they really like hammer that home. And the idea that we're really hard on players when we know that they are good and could be doing better, but we also hate players who are not good.
And then we also love players who are bad because they're like us.
I think that this gets so overcomplicated. I think people like it when the baseball is good and do not like it when it is bad. And I think the whole idea that the crowd as a collective is somehow reading some deeper level into a guy hustling up first base. No, by the time a stadium full of people is booing a guy for not hustling, it's because they've all been stirred up by like local media people like jumping on this person. It's because they all know they're supposed to be upset about it. If that wasn't happening, the Philly sports fans can't like assemble. You know, they can't like they don't.
Yeah, we aren't a collective. Right.
So
Philly, famously hive-minded, the Philadelphia sports fan.
I mean, let me just read you this part from this feature story. It was apparent to everyone that the 1963 Phillies would never lose 23 straight games, and as horrible as it was to contemplate, might even finish in the first division for the first time in 7 years. Phillies fans, of course, were up to some novel tricks to trying to put a stop to this nonsense. A lunatic found a nesting place in the center field bleachers at archaic Connie Mack Stadium and started whipping firecrackers at the hometown outfielders. Hot dog wrappers began cascading down from the stands, causing pitchers and infielders to stand in pools of mustard and waxed paper. Everyone in Philadelphia has suddenly become an expert about the Phils, and everyone believes that the Phillies have faults for which only he can spot. Take Mrs. Janet Rahner, for instance. She believes that the Phils, quote, need some pitching. And Janet Rahner should know, too, because she has sat in her box seat behind home plate, she and her husband, Al, and their 9-year-old French poodle, Caesar, for many a season. So, Trev, this is obviously written somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I think.
That is just a horror story. is going on?
But like, honestly, as a fan of Philadelphia sports teams, do you love losers? Is that something you can say about yourself?
I liked the losers I really enjoyed were the 2012 Orioles team who beat the Red Sox in like the last day of the season and knocked that team out.
But even then, that was one game. They spent a whole season being a real bummer. And that final game was the best game they had played in years. Them celebrating as if they'd won a playoff game was like so fun and exciting, but also really sad and bittersweet because you're like, this team is now going home and was bad.
Yeah, exactly. It's not as if they're like they won anything serious right now. They won the chance to humiliate their rival, which now that I'm saying it out loud, that's what I like.
It's better than nothing.
Like I liked as a cruel-hearted Philadelphia fan, I liked that they embarrassed their rival. I liked that they made people sad. But I don't like that they if they were my team that I was watching, I wouldn't like that they lost.
I don't understand that. Like, people want the team to be better. I guess it's like if you have a team that I think perhaps it's this. The Philadelphia sports fantasy may be that your team stumbles out the gate, digs a hole for themselves, and then is forced to come back from that deficit and make something of themselves from like the midseason on or something. That's why the 2007.
If only there was some sort of team right now.
The 2007 team that like had to play and win down the stretch. But that's such a rare thing. And you can't love that because you put yourself in that hole. It's not like there's some other entity responsible for putting the Phillies, you know, behind in the standings other than the Phillies.
I think the other thing Phillies fans like is they like when a team is disrespected and somehow good. Like, I think they like it when I think the ideal team is a team that no one thinks is good and makes.
Oh, that's
run.
A better way.
Like, which
yeah,
I mean,
that's a better way to put that.
Yeah, like that would have been last year's team would have been great had they pulled it off. Like, everyone would have loved that because it was like, oh, you didn't think we'd be any good, but we actually are. And now don't you look stupid? Which is, I mean, of course, like the most ridiculous way of understanding sports right now. It's like, yeah, I feel like a real boob now that I wrote off the Phillies. I mean, like that's just like, you know, when they keep making Lombardi apologize for calling Doug Peterson a bad coach. Like that. But they wouldn't like it if Doug Peterson kept losing. They were like, apologize, Mike Lombardi. You were correct.
Right. Exactly. That's and like every year there's someone if a Philadelphia sports team is in a promising state, there is someone who will say this team is actually bad. And you know what? 99% of the time, they're right. And it's not because they're smart. It's because the odds are greatly in their favor. You know how the odds were so slim of Mike Lombardi not having to hear about how the year he said that the Eagles won the Super Bowl? Nobody thought that was going to happen. Like, give me a break. He's probably like, God, yeah, why am I the guy?
Just wait, buddy. In 2 years, you're going to be eating your words. It's like, why will he win a Super Bowl? I can't imagine that's going to happen.
Well, I don't think anybody here has ever or will ever love losers. I think they see losers everywhere. You know, even when
we talk about lovable losers all the time, but in order to be lovable, you have to be like good at something. You can't. No one's like, oh, I just miss the where the rubber hits the road is as always in this podcast or often in this podcast, the 2014 and 15 Phillies. And actually the 2016 Phillies, too, where it was like, geez, this is awful. Like, I don't like this at all. None of this is lovable. It's like I don't like watching Jeremy Hellickson and Aaron Harang do things. I don't like I don't like pre-Renaissance Charlie Morton gumming up my team. Like, what am I doing here? Like, why am I watching this? And those aren't feelings.
People watching those teams from season's beginning to season's end were people who had to cover the team professionally and people who, I guess, like had kids who were in like the Phillies broadcast radius and like they were really into baseball. Like how, you know, when you're a kid, like I was like,
I mean, couldn't you get your kid into like Pokemon cards or something at that point? Like just anything. You could do the most unhealthy thing ever. I just don't want to watch this team anymore. Do you want to eat?
That's what I mean. Imagine like reasoned adults watching a team like that all season long just choosing to do that. Like, there's no reason to do that. And if you said, well, I
like these guys because they're fun.
Remember that terrible stretch where they kept making the playoffs? This is a team for me. A team that sucks, has different players every year, players playing the wrong decisions. Oh, look, Delman Young just got picked off second base because he was waving at someone. This is the best day of the summer for me. Hot damn.
Good. They made another trade for Michael. They made a trade for another Young. Like, now the team can have more Youngs on the team, all of whom are terrible.
Well, I think we answered that question. Nobody likes to watch a truly losing baseball team.
And, well, I mean, the other thing people like, though, and I mean, I'll get off this because we have to move on. But the other thing people like is the idea that you are there when bad, right? Like, they like the idea of getting credit.
I
like,
agree.
Okay, I was here when they were this bad. Like, come on, I did it. You know, like, I'm here. I'm a true fan, and it's like, you know, that's annoying. But it's also like, it's also very, very relatable. Like, it's something that I can look at and say, like, yeah, no, I feel that way sometimes. Like, if you suffered through it, you get to sort of like take credit for it. And people like that, but people don't like the suffering.
No.
Part. Like, no one's watching the, you know, like the, no one was watching the Browns the last couple of years and being like, okay, I can't wait till they figure it out, because then I'm going to be one of those guys who's been there in the bad times.
Yeah. I mean,
like, no one seeks
everybody
that
wants the payoff, but nobody loves having to get there. Yeah. I think that's totally correct.
Of course not.
And I guess that's what they're feeding off of. And I mean, part of this is because the Phillies are, throughout their history, so often a bad team, sometimes a disappointingly bad team, a lot of the time, just a bad team. And
it reminds me of someone talking about the Flyers and saying, like, the thing about the Flyers is I don't love the Flyers. I hate them, but coincidentally also want them to win every game.
Exactly. Yes.
Like, that's the Phillies. Yeah, I despise the Phillies. I wish more than anything I could be free of them. But I also will not root for any other
team. And by 1963, I mean, what was their claim to fame? 1915 World Series, 1950 World Series. I'm sure there were a couple of other like competitive teams in there. They were a year removed from 1964, which would seem to solidify their reputation as a team that sucks for a long time.
Truly, truly brutal.
Even though they were, I mean, and even then they were over a decade away from that like mid-70s, early 80s run of success. So they had even less success than we can quote today throughout their history.
Was Steve Carlton actually just still in the Cardinals at this
point? I mean, it's pretty early. I'm not sure. I forget what the span of his career is, but some of the guys he was teammates with were on this team. So, yeah, it's a brutal history. And but at least, you know, the Phillies certainly knew how to beat the Colt 45s most of the time. Trevor, mm-hmm. They went 17-1 against Houston in 1962.
Goodness,
the scales balanced out a little in 1963 with the Phillies only going 10-8 against the upstart Colts, but that left them with a 27-9 record against Houston over the course of 2 years, a stat that should have been appropriately moralizing or demoralizing, depending on the uniform you were wearing. But beating Houston became something of a tradition for these Phillies, to the point that any of their few losses seemed to send manager Gene Mauch into a rage. Oh, and yes, Trev, this is a Gene Mauch game, and we are going to, I'm real quick going to tell you a story of when Joe Morgan, the Houston Colt 45s player who you mentioned earlier, beat the Phillies with a walk-off hit. This is from Tales from the Philadelphia Phillies Dugout, a collection of the greatest Phillies stories ever told by Rich Westcott. Mauch's temper often got the best of him. Such was the case in 1963 when a Houston Colt 45s rookie named Joe Morgan beat the Phillies with a two-out ninth-inning single. "He looks like a little leaguer," Mauch fumed about the 5'7" future Hall of Famer. But that was just a warm-up. When Mauch reached the clubhouse, where the usual post-game meal was spread out on tables, he wasted little time overturning the tables. Food, mostly spare ribs, barbecue sauce, and beverages splattered everywhere, making a terrible mess. Some of it even landed on the clothes of outfielders Wes Covington and Tony Gonzalez. It was not Gene's finest hour. "That was the day," he said later, "that the spare ribs went haywire." Do you think
he's not wrong.
That, No. I mean, this is a scene from the movie Angels in the Outfield when George Knox, as portrayed by Danny Glover, storms into the Angels locker room and flips the post-game spread over. Is this a move? Like, is that a managerial move, or is that just do you think that's an isolated event?
I mean,
throughout manager?
It's just a good being mad move in some ways. And I think, like, the cool thing about it is you get to feel a little bit like Jesus in the like with the money lenders. You get to be like, I'm in charge now and I'm gonna set things straight. If you're a little bit like grandiose, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. I guess, like, if you're mad, you tip things over. Players still, like, destroy the Gatorade stuff, don't they?
Yeah, take the bat to the Gatorade thing, flip the bubblegum basket thing over. Yeah, yeah, I mean, you see that.
I have a lot of spare ribs now in post-game.
I was going to say, match that post-game spread with spare ribs and barbecue sauce. You think that's on Gabe Kapler's post-game spread?
I'm imagining like a modern baseball.
He's got like a honey grow caterer in there.
I'm imagining like a modern baseball player just like eating a big, like helping of mashed potatoes and turkey after a game.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Just like a fire hall dinner in a baseball clubhouse.
Thanks to the Lions era. Club for the spread. This is really good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Gabe Kapler's coming in from like Greensgrove Farms in Kensington, but back then this was like the Knights of Columbus presents mashed potatoes and prime rib,
and they liked it.
Oh yeah, well, and hell, I liked it.
It's like, well, sorry, it's not too healthy. Like, what? We finished the game.
What are you, health? Excuse me, health. What are we, gymnasts? Give me that.
Right now. That's enough of a commitment.
Yeah, it does say just beverages. My first thought was, well, that was obviously like a thermos full of booze.
Of course. Like, what else would it be?
Well, on September 10th, 1963, the Phillies would not have much trouble taking down the Colt 45s, which, despite their staggering dominance of this fledgling franchise, came as a bit of a surprise given who was on the mound for Houston. Now, this isn't going to be anybody that you know. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not setting this up to be like a 12-year-old Nolan Ryan was on the mound that day. No, it's nothing like that. It was Don Nottebohrt, a 27-year-old hurler who'd come to Houston in a trade the previous
year. I only know one thing about him, that he's not a Bart.
And that he had come from Houston in a trade the previous winter. Nottebohrt had made his big league debut in 1960 when the Braves, his parent club at the time, were playing three doubleheaders in 6 days, 1960 style, and they needed some extra meat on the mound. After making a name for himself as a reliever, the Sporting News called him the Braves' best young pitcher and put him in the most likely to succeed club. upgraded to a starter. That was something they did back then. Upgraded to a starter in 1961.
Them in his high school. He's just in the most like
he's climbing the ladder.
Sports Illustrated put me in the most likely to succeed group, but I wanted to be gets the girl.
They call me most likely to not be a Bart, and boy, were they right. Well, 1961, he proceeded to give up the first grand slam of the entire baseball season to a man who had hit only 8 home runs in his entire life. And then a National League record was set when he gave up 2 more home runs that season, or 2 more Grand Slams that season, one of which was to Don Drysdale on the Dodgers.
Goodness.
I mean, he gave up 2 Grand Slams, one to a guy who couldn't even hit more than 8 home runs in his entire career, and one was to a
still
pitcher.
Likely to succeed? So, does he lose his retroactively? Do you lose that?
Well, things... what was interesting was he was referred to as a journeyman, even though I believe he, at this point in his career, he'd only been trained at the one time.
They just meant he was on a journey.
from Boston to Houston, yes. Well, Houston had acquired one of Nottebohrt's old teammates who had told them they should make a trade for him. And so in 1962, they did. He came on. He was like, "You're gonna love this guy. He's got a great pitch. He's a great pitcher. You know, get him in here. He's gonna help a lot." And they were like, "Okay." And they did. And they did it. Like that's
unbelievable.
Yeah, talk about cronyism.
Can you imagine that happening today? Like you sign Manny Machado, and he's like, "Okay, look, what we need is Caleb Joseph. This guy can hit." All right.
Right. Weren't, I believe Todd Zeal and Greg Jeffries were really good friends, and Greg Jeffries like had a full on meltdown when Todd Zeal was traded from the Phillies.
It rocks when like, I mean, like it's like when, I mean, it happens more, I think, in football, because the quarterback is such like an important player. Like that, I think that's why, you know, like why the Eagles brought back Jordan Matthews, because they're like, well, we need a wideout, and this guy's Carson's friend, I guess.
Yeah, who's he gonna throw to better than the guy he's gonna be like having a sleepover with? You know,
the boys are back together again, dude.
Well, they listened to Nottebart, and he wasn't putting up the sexiest numbers in 1963, the season in which he would face the Phillies twice. But he did, Trevor, throw the first ever no-hitter by an NL expansion team pitcher on May 17th of the 1963 season, when his Colt 45s had flummoxed their opponents 4-1. And Trevor, wouldn't you know it, his opponents that day were your own Philadelphia Phillies.
Oh, no.
And that is where the revenge angle comes in, because we can very easily talk about that game, but you know, it was, yeah. And yes, it was a no hitter where the Phillies managed to score a run without getting a hit.
I mean, that's interesting, but rarely do you get dirty innings out of that. Like, no hitters don't usually have the dirtiest of innings, unless it's like a total meltdown by the Phillies. Like, it's like a 16-2 no hitter would be actually awesome. And I would want to talk about that. But like,
yes,
I don't know, 4-1. It's like, well, okay, yeah, it's interesting that they scored a run without getting a hit. That's unique, but it's not going to make for good podcasting.
Oh, I bet they like, you know, put a bunch of singles together and knocked in some runs. And was there a line drive in the corner? Oh, cool. Let's talk about that for an hour.
Do a dirty inning about like three hits. Man, wouldn't you know it? Double play. Well, that's it for the dirty inning.
Wouldn't you know it? Doesn't that beat all? Yeah, Nottebart hadn't had an easy go of it that day on May 17th. But as you can see, his offense allowed a run when the Phillies dunned. Demeter reached on an error, got to third base, and scrambled home on a Don Hoke sack fly. He'd also had to deal with the most dangerous hitters in the Phillies order in the game's final inning.
Did the psychopath hit?
And with the Phillies beating the Colt 45s in 21 of their previous 23 games, it was easy to envision the game going the other way. But no, Nottebart was able to seal the game shut. When you said psychopath, were you talking about Gene Mock?
No, I was talking about the guy who threw the fireworks and mustard.
No, I mentioned that because Gene Mock, Nottebart had to, they said, oh, his teammates stopped talking to him, I think, in like the fifth inning, and he didn't hear too much from the other dugout, but he did say he heard Gene Mock shouting, "You'll never make it. You'll never make it."
That's awesome. Why do people not like Gene Mock?
I don't know.
Sounds really good to me.
I put a Gene Mock quote in my Twitter profile the other day, and it's staying there.
You're never going to make it.
Yeah,
that's a great thing to yell at a pitcher who's in the middle of a no-hitter. Can you imagine how much ink would be spilled today if a manager did that, but also how awesome it would be?
In an era when like he's lauded or at least known for his like cantankerous temperament, but also an era where you could probably like be fined for screaming the F word. So he's just making these like G to PG rated heckles from the dugout.
You can't do it. I've seen your stuff. It's not that good.
The opposite of what you're doing is what I wish would happen.
It's like that. I actually just watched today a Kids in the Hall sketch. Are you a Kids in the Hall guy? It's a good show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a sketch where Kevin McDonald's at a conference and his contacts start hurting. It's like, oh, if only I could remember what my mom told me about what to do here. It's just, remember, never put salt in your eye. And it keeps repeating in his head until it's like, never put salt in your eye. Put salt in your eye. Always put salt in your eye. Like imagining Gene Mock being like, don't forget, throw into the heart of the order. Throw to the heart of the plate.
Put some salt in your eye. Put some salt in your eye. Put some salt in your eye. And he looks up and he's just shouting it over and over again. It's not a flashback. Yeah. Gene Mock, our favorite historical figure on the Phillies.
What a hero.
Yeah. Well, after the May 17th no-hitter, Nottebart's next time facing the Phillies wouldn't be until this day, September 10th, 4 days after the 100,000th Major League Baseball game of all time had been played between the Washington Senators Jeez. And the Cleveland Indians.
Which
the
Why Senators did we watch won this game? That is
100,000.
I like that we feel okay making fun of like people who watch big like long animes and stuff. Like, oh man, you watch like 400 episodes of a cartoon. Like, you watch a sport that has 100,000 games in 1963. Yeah, look, they're all important too.
What are they up to, you think? I don't know. We can probably only imagine. There's no way to track it.
They have to have doubled it by this point, I would think.
Man.
Because there's so many more teams.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They must have they're at an even faster pace. The slowest game at its fastest pace. Baseball, 2019.
What a nightmare.
Well, this game on September 10th between the Phillies and Colt 45s would quite decidedly and quite early be going the Phillies' way. One of their most convincing victories in their recent history, the Inquirer's Alan Lewis put it.
Always despite, a good thing to write.
Despite the hype, Gene Mock's Phils were largely non-factors in the Dodgers' crushing of the National League in 1963. Sandy Koufax and the previously mentioned Don Drysdale pretty much ran the show. By which I mean they ran over the senior circuit and then ran over the Yankees in the World Series without stopping to take a breath. They beat the Yankees in four games, shutting down the likes of Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle.
Are those guys good? I haven't gotten to season 95 of baseball.
I'm still binging. It is very early. When was Rogers Hornsby?
I'm only on 1922 right now, so did I start more home runs in later seasons?
On September 10th, the Phillies were buried in fifth place in the East under 11.5 games, as well as under the Dodgers, Cardinals, Braves, and Giants. They'd lost four in a row, nine of their last 13, and their last seven home games. So, you know, as a town that loved losers, people were probably in just the most spectacular of moods. This is what we wanted. This is the outcome we hoped for.
Everyone's just having a blast. Come on down to
Connie Mack.
Yeah, it was a Connie Mack then. I almost said Ebbets Field. Come on down to crazy old Ebbets Field. This is where the Phillies play.
Come on down to the broken glass strewn lot on which we watch our Phillies fall and bleed. This game would see the most runs they'd scored in a single game in 3 years, as well as their biggest margin of victory in the better part of a decade.
Wow, how many runs? Don't keep me in suspense. How many runs did they score?
The Phillies would win this game 16-0.
Okay, that's a lot. I mm-hmm. will say that's a good amount of runs. I thought you were gonna say like it was like nine because they were that. not many.
This was, and it's easy to see why. Like, the Phillies didn't just win this. They didn't go out there and say, like, let's get in the zone here and let's really take it to these Colts today. No, they were helped a great deal. But, you know, you got to say, Phillies starter Chris Short would have 8 strikeouts, matching a career high. Johnny Callison would contribute 2 singles, a double, and a 3-run home run.
I remember
him. And those 63 Phils would end the season on an 11-6 run, good enough for, like, fourth place, I guess, and to be entirely forgotten. But today, September 10th, they were about to make a mess out of Houston, and they didn't have to wait very long. So, the actual inning itself, the bottom of the first inning.
Can I say that it's exciting how we started this like about the innings, and over time it has become less and less about the innings? Like, I think today's inning is going to take up less than a third of the show, which is really cool.
which is really cool. I think when people see a podcast with the word inning in it, the last thing they want to hear about is the thing that's in the middle.
Yeah. What was the dirty inning? Oh, no one's asking that. Everyone wants to know more about Gene Mock and my thinking on it.
and the things he's done.
Trevor, talk more about Gene Mach.
Why aren't they talking about Gene Mach now?
Everyone calm down.
Well, Chris Short put the Colt 45s down 1-2-3 in the first inning. And the Phillies came up to bat, you know, nothing, bottom of the first. Tony Taylor was leading off. Don Nottebart on the mound, the no-hitter fresh in his mind. And on the second pitch at the at-bat, he nails Tony Taylor with a pitch. And we are off to the races, my friend, as Taylor jogs down to first base. Johnny Callison steps in next. He strikes out swinging. And this is when the trouble starts for Houston. Houston would have six errors on the day for their part. Four hits and six errors and no runs. It is a pretty negative day for the Colt 45s. Meanwhile, the Phillies would have 17 hits, 16 runs on 17 hits. So they were efficiently producing or the recipients of some fairly serendipitous defensive miscues, one of which occurred during Wes Covington's at-bat against Don Nottebart as he came up third. And Tony Taylor goes to steal second. And wouldn't you know it, the catcher's throw is terrible. Trickles into the outfield. Taylor runs to third base. And Covington obliges the error by smacking a double to left field, allowing Tony Taylor to score. That brought up Tony number two, Tony Gonzalez, who singles to left.
I love Tony two.
Tony two. Who singles to left. Covington heads to third base. Tony Gonzalez, again, advances to second base on the throw home. So once again, there's runners with two runners in scoring position. That brings up Roy Sievers, who strikes out swinging, followed by Clay Dalrymple, who was intentionally walked. And that, Trevor, brings up Don Hoke to the plate. So okay. Don Hoke, he's a man. He's our guy. Hoke was playing
did
third.
Did he score the run in the no-hitter?
He did. Yes. Okay. So he factored into two of Nottebart's starts. Significantly.
You think I don't listen to you when you do these things, but I do.
I do think
that. I've read your journal.
Hoke was playing third base for the Phillies that day. This was his first year with the Phillies and the second to last season of Major League Baseball in which he would appear. He was 35. He was hitting .221, the highest his batting average had been in about a month. He'd been acquired in a trade with the Pirates for Ted Savage, with the idea being that putting Hoke at third would let the Phillies put Don Demeter in the outfield where he belonged, and the whole machine would function a little more properly with the parts in the right places.
Shades of Rhys Hoskins.
Uh-huh. As it turns out, Christopher Threston writes in The Integration of Baseball in Philadelphia, the trade failed for both teams.
One of those rare lose-lose trades you always talk about.
Poor Don. To Hoke's credit, 3 days after this game, he would help the Phillies salvage an unlikely win against future World Series champion and terrifying pitching man, Sandy Koufax. For some reason, Chris Short started this game, the following game, 3 days after September 10th, and I guess that would be September 13th. Chris Short started this game on a few hours rest, which is to say, I guess, you know, like 72 hours rest, but still a very small amount of rest.
Like what? how much rest did he have? 3 hours?
A bus ride, you know.
All right, Chris, did you get some sleep on the bus? Yeah. No, I was playing my Game Boy the whole time, coach.
Well, I hope you did, because you're pitching and you have to face Sandy Koufax. Good luck. Get out there.
Oh, no. I did read all those Pokemon, but...
Man, you are really pushing.
I get Pokemon reference. I'm not even playing any Pokemon games. I don't know what's with me.
Well, a battle ensued in this day, Trevor, but not between pocket monsters, but between Chris Short and Sandy Koufax.
Good.
Uh-huh. So Chris Short struck out 14 hitters and allowed 4 hits, and the Phillies outfoxed Sandy Koufax in the fifth when Don Hoke singled, stole second on a wild breaking ball, and raced to third on his middle-aged knees when the catcher took his sweet time getting the ball. Then the Phillies dropped a bunt down the third base line, and Hoke had to run home after all of the running he had already done. And he managed to cross the plate safely, so it's 1-0 in the ninth. And Chris Short goes back out there. He gives a look to Don Hoke from across the dugout that says, "Thank you, old man. You did this for me. I'm going back out there. And I'm going to make this win a part of our shared lore. Don't you worry about a thing." And he goes out there and he promptly gives up a two-run shot to Frank Howard, a man who was 6 foot 8 inches tall and who hit the ball so hard all the Phillies could do was stare at it. When he hit that home run, I almost died, Chris Short said later to reporters. So down 2-1 in the bottom of the ninth, the Phillies led off with a single and a hit batsman, followed by a sack bunt from Ruben Amaro's grandfather. With two runners in the scoring position, Don Hoke was
walked. What a horrible team.
Don Hoke was walked on purpose and saved the game when, as a double play ball rolled to shortstop, decimated the defender with a takeout slide and kept the game from being ended on a twin killing.
Classic.
Not the actual killing he had just committed with his legs and body. Both runners came around to score, and the Phillies won 3-2. And then Trevor, his knees sore, his body freshly collided with, and a game-saving breakup of a double play, Don Hoke stood up, got his glove, and went to third base to play an entire other baseball game because it was a doubleheader.
I like that Don Hoke is a huge failure as like an acquisition and all, but they still intentionally walked him. We're going to have to intentionally walk, Archimedes Gamboa here. We'll definitely have to walk, Corey Patterson, who we got on a minor league deal and playing, got to make sure to walk Jordan Danks. Make sure he's not going to hurt you.
Come on. What else? Who else you got? Go ahead. Come on. John Boozer.
Yeah. Wes Helms. We got to walk Wes Helms. I can keep going.
We know them all, folks. Well,
we know all the bad players.
Just to return to September 10th, it was Don Hoke's at bat that day that can serve as the very early breaking point for the Phillies' opponent, too. Because as we related to you, already the Phillies are up 1-0. There are two outs from two strikeouts that Don Nautabart was able to get, but he's already hit a guy. He's already seen an error, throwing error from his catcher, allowing a guy to reach third base. He's already seen an RBI double, a single, and then just intentionally walked Clay Dalrymple. And up comes Don Hoke to the plate. The Inquirer says that Hoke, quote, hit a shot through the Houston third baseman. So we can only assume there was a man on the field with a smoking hole where his chest cavity used to be.
Violent game. It's a different era.
Wes Covington scored, Tony Gonzalez scored, and there were still two runners in scoring position for the Phillies. Bobby Wine followed Hoke and hit another hard grounder to shortstop where the defender went to field it but got thrown off when Hoke acrobatically leaped over the ball to avoid it, allowing another run to score. Chris Short, the pitcher, came up next and was awarded a base on catcher's interference.
Jeez.
But the
Nothing
inning was
going right, huh?
The inning was only one batter longer after that.
This is truly a dirty inning for this is amazing. It's really,
I keep
forgetting that other teams have these.
Oh yeah, I know. Like seeing this inning, it was like, wait, this was for the Phillies?
This sounds like a Phillies inning right now.
When you look at the box score, I mean, it's a mess. Especially, I centered on that Don Hoke at bat for a reason, because the three scoring plays of this inning, Wes Covington's RBI double, and then the other two are Don Hoke reaching on an error on the third baseman and Bobby Wine reaching on an error on the shortstop, with Hoke scoring two runs and Bobby Wine scoring one. And there's just like all that. Oh, this run is unearned. E5, this goes here, this up and down to the right, carry the one. Like, it's a mess. It's a mess.
It's a classic dirty inning. It's perfect.
And Tony Taylor flies out to right field. The Phillies are up 4-0. But honestly, the game was far, far, far from over. As I said, the Phillies would win this game 16-0, thanks mostly to Johnny Callison, Tony Gonzalez, Chris Short, Don Hoke at the center of the circus in the first, was the only one to go 0-for-4 on the day and score no runs.
Who is this?
Don Hoke.
Wait, Don Hoke scored no runs? And went, that's amazing. He was so important.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So the Phillies scored in every inning except for the third and the seventh. They had a 5-run sixth, and Houston committed 6 errors. Per the Inquirer's Alan Lewis, it was, quote, the worst defeat in the 2-year existence of the Texans, which they were pretty liberal with nicknames back in the day. Like the other teams, when you're Texans. Like reading old newspapers and you realize they're like, they're using just a different name to refer to a team because it like entered their heads and they were like trying to be poetic. So they used a lot of creative license in that way back in this era.
That's very creative.
Yes.
I was like, wait, were they ever called the Texans? Is that a thing?
The Phillies.
No, but also, yes.
When the Phillies came back in the second inning, it was a series of RBI singles that allowed them to build a 7-0 lead. When they scored in the fourth, it was a Bobby Wine RBI double. Tony Gonzalez scored on a pass ball in the bottom of the fifth, allowing for that run. Bottom of the sixth was Johnny Callison's 3-run shot, and then Tony Gonzalez hit a 2-run shot. So they scored the most runs in any single inning in that one, but it was their most succinct scoring attack. Ruben Amaro actually hit an RBI single to score Dick Allen in the bottom of the eighth. That was all she wrote. They were up 16-0 at that point. The Colt 45s were on their only third pitcher of the day. They had Dick Drott go out there and pitch 6 innings of just disgusting mop-up duty.
Nice. I love it. Just let him wear it. This guy got paid like 35 cents.
He's begging to come out of the game. It's like, don't let him out. Stay out there.
He's got to get what he deserves.
I don't like how this guy looked at my wife.
Why are you doing this?
It's easily the most hits that Dick Drott gave up in a single appearance that season with 10. And easily the most earned runs as well. The most earned runs he'd allowed in an appearance beyond that was 4. Or 6 in his last start. But before that, it was just, a couple of times he'd had a mess on his hands and allowed 4 runs. But yeah, that was a brutal day for everyone wearing a Houston uniform. And
you mean Texans.
Oh, sorry, wearing a Texan uniform. But yeah, thought it was a pretty
rough day for the Lone Star.
Terrific way to start the season with the Phillies beating up on the sun-bleached cattle skulls the way they did. And I think we can look forward to a couple of new ideas on Dirty Innings in the near future, frankly, Trev. I don't know what you've got planned, but
think so?
I
gotta say, I was joking around with Justin about who's, if this is his podcast or multiple people's podcasts, but I will say you are so good recently with your research. I just like, you're just on point. I haven't had much of a chance to really think it through. So I'm going to have to up my game.
Well, it's either this or revenge plots. So I've worked through most of my checklist. Got a lot of.
It really does explain why your production came up so much.
A lot of my
after all the tragic deaths of your foes.
A lot of crossed off names on my enemies list. If you know what I mean.
it's weird how all those foes of yours die.
All in like systematic, vaguely connected ways. It's so interesting.
Yeah, really poetic ways too. It's just surprising. I'm not saying anything about if you're guilty or what you did or didn't do, or if I'm asking if you did or didn't do it. It's just, it makes you think.
Just like
let's just say
in ways that reflected your relationship with them. It springs to mind, certainly. Yes.
Wow, it's funny that my old boss died choking on a litter opener after he fired me by mail. That is funny, Justin.
Wow, that's weird.
I guess it's funny the way you put that.
We're recording this, right? Well, in any case, folks, we thank you for listening to The Dirty Inning, both this year and in the year to come. Of course, this is part of the Good Fights podcast family, which is seeing massive success with all of the sexy happenings with the Philadelphia Phillies, despite it being the offseason. So be sure to check in with Hittin' Season with John Stolness, myself, and Liz Rocher, as well as John Stolness's midweek episode, which he talks to an industry insider and just discusses the Phillies topics of the day. They just signed David Robertson lately, so that's current news of the day.
Lately they signed.
I'm trying to keep it vague, depending on when
the word that is most often used to describe what you've been doing over a period of time. Like, what have you been up to? Well, lately I've been signing David Robertson to a 2-year contract with a club option.
Well, we hope you check in with that and as catch up with continued success with myself and Liz Rocher, which is going
to
be.
Yeah, that's coming to an end, isn't it?
Which is.
You're almost through that.
Oh, no, we are through. The initial premise was that we were recapping the anniversaries of 2008, 1993 teams, but we're obviously going to be talking about other things on that podcast. So
it's going to continue. That's great news.
Yeah, we've got plenty more to go on that, and that'll pick up after its holiday hiatus as well. So be sure to subscribe, download, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your loved ones that
don't tell your enemies.
I'll take care of your enemies. But if you like the Phillies and if anyone you know likes the Phillies,
that's a Patreon tier.
I'll take care of your enemies. No further description. Well, we thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time on the Dirty Inning.
Bye.
Hey everybody, how you doing? Well, that's good. My name is Bill Matz. I am the director of Fun and Games for Broad Street Hockey Radio Podcasts.
And I am Kelly, the deputy managing editor of BroadStreetHockey.com.
I'm Steph Driver, the NHL editorial manager for SB Nation.
And I am Charlie O'Connor, lead Flyers writer for TheAthletic.com.
And together we make up BSH Radio, one of the shows that you get at the SB Nation podcast family. We have a lot coming to you this year, and we want you to listen to our show. It is just an all Flyers, all the time show, so much content. I really hope you listen to it. It is a great piece of the SB Nation podcast family, along with all your other favorite sports.
We all love hockey, specifically the Flyers.
Let's go the Flyers.
The hockey team of Flyers.